Almost 7 years after the half-cooked rally that still shook the world, you may be a bit weary of hearing about Charlottesville. But the enemy insists on keeping that glorious, if tumultuous, day relevant. From Biden using footage of the march down Market Street at the top of his campaign ads, to an Antifa doxing campaign that persists to this day, to a very belated legal persecution of the brave men who held their tiki torches high that night, it's clear that the mere assembly of 1,000 or more pro-white advocates remains a looming specter that the left insists on casting out. Only instead of a crucifix, they use Jewish money, leftist lawyers, and judges' gavels. This week, we finally welcome the fearless and stalwart Greg Conte, who's been keeping tabs on the sordid legal proceedings down Virginia way, to discuss what's going on, what it means, what we can do to help, and a lot more. So, Mr. Producer, hit it. Welcome, everyone, to Full House, the world's least apologetic show for white fathers, aspiring ones, and the whole biofam. It is episode 183, and I am your slightly sunburned host, Coach Finstock, back with another 2 hours of truth in podcasting. I'm sunburned because I did follow the spirit of our garden extravaganza from last week and spent the majority of the day out there digging holes and planting fruit trees shirtless. It was glorious. Paying for it now, though. It's a lot of work digging up virgin soil. Before we meet the birth panel, though, shameful showing in the support score this past week. But that means we are even more grateful then to Charles and Unsung for their generosity. And Unsung said, "Gents, been listening for about a year. Live in the Midwest and am building our home in a quiet part of our state. We just had a son and we named him Armin after Prince Arminius. Can you give him a shout out on the show?" You bet your ass we can give him a shout out, Unsung. Congratulations, big guy. Wonderful name for your son. It doubles. Armin Van Buren is a wonderful DJ. Bet you didn't know that, but you could stick with Arminius for the honorific for sure. Way to go, buddy. And thank you for the donation. With that, let's get cracking. First up, in our thing, he is still referred to as the Charlottesville Shirker, but he's certainly been making amends here over the years for his dereliction of duty that day. Sam, welcome back. Every time this comes up.
I know. At the time, I just had I had a sense that, hey, this is not going to turn out good, you know? And I've usually been reticent to go too far out of town for something like that anyway. So it certainly was a glorious moment of lifting the middle finger to the system, but unfortunately there's ramifications still playing out to this day. And I feel for anybody who's caught up in that for sure.
Yep.
But yeah,
we can blame our special guest in large part for how things went that day.
Very interesting special guest for sure. I'm looking forward to this one.
Long overdue. Yeah.
Yeah.
How was your Easter, buddy?
Oh, wonderful. And, you know, my daughter-in-law now has been staying here for a while with us, and my son is here with her. And, you know, we hear a lot about in our thing about guys have a hard time getting a good steady girl or getting married and stuff like that. But in fact, people are getting married, and I think it would be interesting to have them on the show to talk about exactly that part of it. Meeting somebody, getting married, how do you know? How do you propose the question? How do you know it's the right one? All that type of thing. She's been perfectly lovely to be here in the house. We had a lot of good conversations because she's versed in our topics and things like that.
I thought
that.
You were going to say she's a virgin. I was like, oh, no. TMI, no. Sam. Good for Sonny Boy.
You're right. But yeah, so, you know, maybe we can get them on a show coming up and talk about that part. Just, you know, it's good to hear a fresh report of success, right?
Absolutely. Let's do it soon.
All right.
Thank you, Sam. Welcome back. And next up, don't know, but he actually flew in to march in Kessler's Seaville 2.0 DC edition to try to capture the spirit of the original day. He's dressed as a Viking and people just thought that he was a street performer. Rollo, welcome back, bud.
Well, actually, I was a street performer. I just ended up wandering into the march by accident.
Okay. Truth be told. Yeah, I know a couple guys who went to Charlottesville, but they had on like the black rim glasses and a mustache and a big nose to try to blend in. You know, they wanted to be there, but they didn't want to be, they wanted to be of it, but not in it perhaps. So that was you with Kessler. How's it going, big guy?
You know, the sun still rises in the morning.
Fair enough. All right. Well, with that, finally, our very special first time guest, long overdue. He has been an activist, organizer, podcaster, writer, speaker, researcher for close to a decade now. He's probably done a lot more than that we don't know about. He's not exactly warm and cuddly, and he might be the first white nationalist I've ever met who doesn't do group chats, but I am damn glad he's on our side all the same, and he's probably the last guy on earth I would ever suspect of going wobbly. Greg Conte, welcome to Full House. What is going on?
Well, thanks for that introduction, Coach. So, yeah, you mentioned the Charlottesville stuff, and that's why I wanted to come on the show, in addition to, you know, hanging out and talking with you guys.
Sure.
Charlottesville, so you wrote an article on this, and to kind of bring people up to speed on these latest prosecutions. In the last, like, year, it was about a year ago, the Admiral County prosecutor decided that he wanted to start bringing criminal cases against people who had held a tiki torch at Charlottesville on the night of August 11th when we all did that tiki torch march, for violating this obscure Virginia statute. Even it's so obscure the cops didn't even know about it, that says you're not allowed to burn an object with the intent to intimidate somebody. And this, you know, 6 years after the fact.
Yep.
And I think it's been about 10 or 12 guys have gotten arrested on this over the last year. There's an unknown number of secret indictments against people in this. But the bottom line on all of it is that this is entirely as you would deduce, right? This is entirely a political move on the part of Charlottesville and on the part of UVA. Mm-hmm. So it's completely motivated by just malice, and it's legally questionable. And I wrote a couple articles on it in the last couple weeks because I've been getting into doing some research on it. And you find so much out about the night of August 11th, just reading like random articles, open source stuff, like just UVA publications, UVA law publications. You read the Heafy report, which was compiled after Charlottesville at the behest of the city. You can read lots of news articles like Seaville Weekly, you know, New York Times, all that stuff. And like piecing together who was where and who was doing what, you start to find some very interesting things out. Now, in these prosecutions, the first thing that immediately jumped out, I did a little bit of research back in the summer and forwarded a little of this information to people. But the first thing that immediately jumped out at me, and I'm not sure if I'm the only person who figured this out. Other people probably did too, so I don't want to like claim total credit for it. But was the fact that one of the judges who was sending guys or locking guys up and denying them bail was a possible witness to the events that of this very thing, Judge Claude Worrell.
Right. He's the one who looks like Daryl Lamont Jenkins on Ozempic a little bit. He's got those bug eyes. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, please.
I didn't know what he looked like. I don't think I've seen a picture of him.
He's like a light skinned black guy with sort of bulgy eyes and not as quite as obese as Daryl.
Well, it's funny with him because it was just, he knew where he was. He was across the street. So the Tiki Torch March ended at the Jefferson statue at UVA campus right up by the rotunda. And there's a church across the street called St. Paul's Episcopal. And at that church was like the entire gentry and elite of Charlottesville, and including like national people too. I mean, you had the mayor of Charlottesville there, Siner. You had a lot of UVA people there, including like the head of the religious studies department, who fell in with the security provided by this Antifa group called Redneck Revolt that y'all know. And you also had like national people there, like that black guy who always wears black suits just in case he dies, Cornel West, the funny like black that guy. I feel like it would be cruel to say anything too mean about him, but he was there giving speeches. Katie Couric was there. I mean, like, this was not just a bunch of random, you know, townspeople. I mean, it was a lot of people from the town, but this was very much a elite gentry thing. And they're having this meeting at St. Paul's Church right across the street from where the statue, where they know through, because the information was leaked, like they know through leaked information that Antifa found and distributed, that's where our march is going to end. And they had planned this. I mean, they'd planned it quite deliberately. And so there's some question now, like, how does this relate to the ongoing prosecutions? Well, there's some question now as to, were people who were at that church like witnesses? Because the screwed up thing about Virginia is we don't even know. I mean, and I don't think even a lot of the defendants necessarily know who the witnesses are that the prosecution's bringing, what even the general theory of the prosecution is, and what the evidence is against them. I know the lawyers do have some access to like certain types of evidence, but it's actually very restrictive, and you only get the witnesses before you about 10 days before trial. So, and actually from the preliminary hearings, it sounds like the prosecutor's office isn't even sure who the witnesses are, because according to the chief prosecutor, Hinsley, and we can talk more about him, Jim Hinsley, He says that it's just people who are at the statue. So like people who are in the general area of the Jefferson statue, those are people who are going to be brought as witnesses against these defendants. Right. But according to the main guy who's doing kind of the front man or the lead guy for the prosecutor's office, Lawton Tufts, who incidentally also might be a witness, he says that it could be broader. It might be people at the church. It might be people who are elsewhere on campus. They might also qualify as witnesses or as you know, potentially people who were intended to be intimidated and therefore can be brought as a witness.
Right. So let me step back here for a second. So we've got 10 or 12 guys who have been, I guess, served their indictment, or they've been arrested, or they've been, you know, moved to Albemarle County for processing, including Thomas Rousseau now, as we know, from Patriot Front. I believe that several guys pled guilty already and got a sentence. I don't think there's been a trial of any
there's
of
not been yet. Not been a trial. A couple of them did take plea deals for it, but no, there's not been a trial yet. And it'll be interesting when there is a trial, because this law has not been tried at all before. Or maybe it has like once or something, but I don't think it's ever been used before. So it's going to be precedent setting when this is actually tried. And so it's certain things like jury instructions, for instance, are going to be very important, because that's never been, they don't have like a set list of jury instructions like you would in like a common assault case or something like that. So all that, whoever goes first needs to have, their lawyer needs to be really on top of things and really go hard on every single thing, because that's going to set precedent for everything else.
Right. A couple of things jump off the page on this one. Of course, you've got the significant delay in prosecution, which is 100% transparent that it's political. The previous attorney refused to bring charges. He didn't think there was a case. Holding a tiki torch while marching, regardless, you know, saying Jews will, even if what was the worst thing said, quote unquote, worst thing said, Jews will not replace us. That is not like standing in front of your black neighbor's house with a burning cross saying, you know, I'm going to lynch you, darkie. And of course, you were there. And as circumstance has it, you did not hold a torch that night. And you witnessed the discussions with the cops, the orderly procession. Antifa clearly occupied the statue territory in order to provoke the conflict. You guys didn't go around Kristallnacht style and smashing windows or starting fires. The whole thing is astounding that they're bringing it. And even though it's in Albemarle County, it seems like it's on really shaky ground. And I think, I don't know if it was Augustus's lawyer or a different lawyer. The small victories thus far include getting Wuerl and maybe Tufts, maybe the whole office thrown off the case.
Yes,
where are we now? That's the big one. Yeah.
It was Frazier, the lawyer for Jacob Dix. Okay. So he got Lawton Tufts and Wuerl. Wuerl recused himself and Lawton Tufts had to be forced out. But the new judge who was brought in after Wuerl got kicked off agreed with Frazier, the lawyer's argument that Lawton Tufts, the guy, he was actually in communication with Antifa during this whole thing. He was at Charlottesville on August 12th. Right. Nobody knows where he was on August 11th. He claims to have a kid. So,
that doesn't mean anything these days. Yeah. Go ahead, bud. Sorry.
Yeah. But anyway, so nobody knows where Lawton was. I thought he'd been at the church cause somebody who had been at one of the hearings thought he had said that, but that wasn't correct. We're not sure if he was at the church. Nobody knows. And he won't say, nobody knows where he was, but he got forced off the Jacob Dix case, because of conflict of interest and because, I didn't think the judge specifically said this, but because, yeah, he's maybe a potential witness. It's not really clear if he's a witness. But he hasn't gotten forced off Augustus Invictus's case, and Augustus Invictus has a different judge. He has Richard Moore, the guy that tried a bunch of the Charlottesville cases, including James Fields, who had to be brought out of retirement to hear this case because the entire bench recused themselves. They had to bring a guy from out of town and they had to bring more back to hear these cases. So you also have that problem there where it's not really clear. Lawton Tufts isn't allowed to be on one case, but he's allowed to be on another with a different judge. So yeah. This seems like, you know, something that needs to get settled. But in Virginia law, the way I understand it's probably going to work is you're going to have somebody get convicted before this can get appealed.
Sordid, swirling legal drama. Now, the whole thing is astounding. Although, you know, of course, we're not really surprised by any of this stuff. It's sort of like, you know, everything that's going on in England with their persecution of people for free speech. It reeks of that in almost, you know, sort of baby steps here. Obviously, there's malice and vengeance involved here. If it were up to the commies of Charlottesville, you know, we'd all be swinging from tree limbs. But I guess the question is, why are they doing it in this way with a sort of long, dragged out drip of arrests? And
what's the same? Reason. Yeah, it's the same reason that they do what they do with Trump. Like, our entire society now is based on conspiracy theory law. Conspiracy theories aren't allowed in the press, and they're not allowed in history class. Conspiracy theories are always not true, except in the courts where they are always true. Everything is a conspiracy. So the way it's done, you know, this passes for legal strategy in this country. Is you find some low tier person, somebody who probably can't defend themselves. You stack a bunch of charges on them. You force them to sign a deal, and then you use you use that case as precedent to say, well, there was a crime committed here. You also were there. Therefore, there was a conspiracy. And this is like, it's incredible. You know, if you were to reform the legal system, the first thing I'd do is, well, maybe not the first thing, but one of the first things I'd do is say, all right, well, anytime you want to bring a conspiracy charge, you need to bring it immediately, and you need to bring it against every single person who was there, and we need to have a mass trial immediately. Because otherwise, right, like, you know, you can just do this forever.
Yeah. Drip, drip into November and the election, which I'm sure is on the back of somebody's mind, whether it's Hinsley or the puppeteers. You were there. This is obviously personal for you. You were there that night. I got to ask, should everyone who carried from what, you know, you're digging into this, and good on you for that, should everyone who carried a torch that night be preparing for the knock at the door, or the broken down door in the middle of the night? You think it's coming to this or to that, or are they picking off the most prominent, or perhaps those who got a little bit rowdy in self-defense that night?
I would say probably the second one, the latter.
Right. Uh-huh.
But the thing is that you really can't, I don't want to, like, you can't count on that. You know, in a way, but it's also like not something that you should be, you know, freaking out about, because I mean, I understand the feeling, obviously, like any day in this country now, you could be arrested on, somebody might rat you out for something you didn't do, and then cops come and drag you out in the middle of the night, and they throw you through, put you through the ringer, and they it takes them years to figure out, oh yeah, well, actually, we weren't supposed to do that. Okay, go away. So, the thing about this, though, is it's been amazing to me in researching this stuff, how little has been figured out about the UVA Law School and UVA and the prosecutor's office, and how all these people are linked to one another, and how all of them are friends with one another. So I'm going to give you guys something. So I sent you I showed you the two articles that I've written about this. The first one, I kind of explained the background on the Tiki procession and all the stuff about that, and how Antifa works, and how this is a typical Antifa thing. Like when Antifa shows up, there's violence. Sure. When our people show up alone, there's nothing.
We were both there for the May rally. Yeah. Right. And it went on fire. Go ahead. Sorry.
But we don't, you know, nobody on our side attempts to go track down Antifa. This is an obvious pattern through years, but it isn't like acknowledged in law. So the legal system can pretend that isn't the case, and they can isolate one little incident and then say, okay, well, see, there was violence here, and that must have been because of you. And it takes years to sort it out to realize that, no, it was actually Antifa that did this. But regardless of that, so getting to my second article, I talk more about the specific connections between these Antifa people, some of them including Emily Grzynski, Edward Grzynski.
Thank you.
Some of the key instigators here, and their direct connections to the prosecutor's office. Maybe not acknowledged by the prosecutor's office, but certainly acknowledged by Grzynski. So Grzynski bragged on a podcast back in October that he had convinced the prosecutor to bring these cases. Mm-hmm. You know, that seems like a conflict of interest. The other thing too, and this is new, I haven't written any articles about this, but I did mention Sonia Smith in the second article, I think it was. So Sonia Smith is this billionaire born in Brooklyn, lives in Charlottesville. She's married to another billionaire by the name of Michael Bills. I don't know if Smith is Jewish. I kind of assume so, but I haven't seen anything to prove it, so I can't. I don't know. Doesn't really matter. Her and her husband, Michael Bills, are like some of the key movers and shakers in Virginia politics. And their daughter, Kendall Bills, was at Charlottesville with Antifa. Sonia Smith was the key donor, I guess we say, to Hingley, the prosecutor. She gave him $114,000, and her daughter was with Antifa at Charlottesville. And you also have another interesting connection here. This family is friends with this guy by the name of Perriello, Tom Perriello. He's now in the Sudan as Joe Biden's like envoy to the Sudan for whatever purpose. He's like, I guess, Joe Biden's General Gordon.
All these guys that lose their congressional seats and they go on to sort of like busybody assignments. Perriello's been popping around a lot of different
offices. Coach, do you know about Perriello?
Yeah. He was at the State Department. He was like in charge of some reorganization or some strategy thing. I don't know.
But do you know what else he did? Do you know why? So he was at Charlottesville, first of all, and he was there at Lee Park on August 12th with Antifa. He was running for governor at the time. Do you know what he did between 2018 and July of last year?
Do enlighten me, please.
He ran the Open Society Foundation.
He was the executive director.
He was George Soros's guy putting money. He was that guy. So you have George Soros's guy was, well, he wasn't at the, he got the assignment later, perhaps as a reward for his performance at Charlottesville, who knows, but he was at Charlottesville. And then a year later, he gets promoted to that. He's also buddies with Sonia Smith. And in fact, one of their other kids did an internship for him about 15 or 20 years ago.
New sinecure for the good guy. Yep. Doing the bidding. Hingley, of course. Yeah. One, I believe it was Soros or Open Society or some network of money to get the old guy out.
He didn't. Yeah. He didn't get a ton from, like, Hingley didn't get a ton from Soros. He got about $5,000.
Yeah.
But, which he would have gotten, you know, would have been allocated to him by Perriello because Perriello was running the Open Society Foundation right then. But, but like $5,000 for George Soros is just like kind of nothing because there's some other prosecutors and judges in Virginia who've gotten, you know, tens or nearly 100,000. I think that's the kind of money. That's like the real George Soros people. He's a low tier George Soros person. I mean, I guess he is a George Soros person in the sense that he's kind of, I guess if we want to model this on like the feudal system, like George Soros is the king and Sonia Smith and Michael Bills are like barons or dukes or something, and then he's their direct vassal. Not he isn't directly subordinate to the king. He's subordinate to the king by transitive property of vassalage.
Before we get too far along, Greg, what can, if anything, the audience do here to help? You said Frazier is the lawyer for Jacob Dix. I presume some of the guys have public defenders. I don't know if Glenn and the Free Expression Foundation is involved with a defense for any of these things. Is there any sort of organized defense going on? Augustus probably, he's got his own, Augustus isn't defending himself. He's got an attorney, but
yeah, he's got a guy named, it's this big lawyer in Maryland who's done a bunch of the January 6th ones, Terrell. I forget his name, Terrell something.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, and
anything you're aware of in terms of helping out?
Yeah, so Glenn Allen, you mentioned, I just saw this on Telegram. I don't know directly, but he is, I guess, collecting donations to help out. I think I saw something on Telegram about that. So there is something there. You'll have to verify for me. But you ask a good question. What can people do? Because you know, I write these articles, and I try not to editorialize too much in them. And then a lot of the comments on like, oh my God, it's all hopeless. And what can we do? There's nothing to do. Well, there is something you can do, even as just a disconnected person, even if you don't like have any money to give. One is research, because if you have time, you can start looking into these people and putting some of these pieces together. What I'm telling you now took me like 6 weeks of work to figure out. And I suspect a lot of it was known bits and pieces here and there by other people, but it hadn't been put together. At least that I know of. I haven't seen anybody talk about it or say it. And there's a lot of stuff that I still don't know that would be important in some of these trials. And What's amazing to me about this is that you've had how many Charlottesville cases where how many like lawyers have been involved, how many hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent, and none of these people could like do some open source research, apparently. I mean, it is kind of shocking, actually. I mean, I know a lot of work has been done. Something like Christopher Cantwell in the Kaplan case did an outstanding job, but he was kind of hamstrung because he was in jail at the time and he couldn't really get into the research the way, you know, you or I could just sitting at a computer. So there's a number of things that like we don't know, or at least I don't know, that maybe somebody else out there knows, or somebody could find out. Things like who was at the church, who else was at St. Paul's Church would be one of them. It would be very interesting if Sonia Smith or Michael Bills were at that church because of their connections to Soros, their connections to Hingley, their daughter being hit the next day. And I mean, I guess we'll find out if people at the church are considered witnesses, but can you imagine if the chief funder of the prosecutor not only had a daughter who was hit and was protesting with Antifa and got like I don't think she got a settlement. I think there was some, I forget exactly what her deal was, but she was protesting with Antifa. And also that these people, if they were witnesses, and they could be called into court as a witness. Can you imagine the prosecutor having to cross-examine Sonia Smith, his key donor?
Right.
Like, total clown world. And that's where we're at here with some of these cases is because I think our guys have started to realize, or at least it seems Peter Frazier has realized this just from looking at the way he's handled the Dix case. It seems clear that he's realized that a lot of these typical legal arguments that you would do, you try to like throw off a motion to dismiss based on the statute not being being too broad or something. Just the basic legal stuff that you would try to do, you still have to do it, but it's not enough. And what you have to do is you have to find the not just conflicts of interest, but actual like clear corruption, things that violate such utterly basic legal principles that they probably aren't even written down. It's so obvious, like the judge can't be a witness, you know, like stuff like that.
Greg, were you arrested the next day for civil disobedience when they were trying to chase us out of the park? I remember you were certainly like there in the thick of it.
No, I wasn't arrested. So what happened was, you know, they maced all of us, and Richard Spencer was super maced, and he kind of had enough of it, and I sort of dragged him out, or I wouldn't say dragged. He was blind, so you know, blinded by mace, so he couldn't really see. We went over to the side there, and he like asked the cops, like, "Can you help us, or can you let us go out?" Like indicating, you know, one of the safe directions, which were north or west, or any direction other than south, other than out onto Market Street. And the cops were like, "Oh, you know, we're gonna stick our hands in our vests like morons and chomp on a donut. We can't do anything." So I had a decision to make, and it was like, well, I either stand here with Richard Spencer and wait till people realize and, you know, then like decide to lynch us, or I grab him and go. So I picked the second one.
Very good. Yeah, the thought has occurred to me, you know, since we have this no statute of limitations on felonies in Virginia that they have helpfully reminded us here, a ton of our guys got assaulted, beaten, maced, etc. The thought occurs that this could be put to the test. I was assaulted that day, got on video, reaching for my friend's hat, clubbed over the head, etc. Identify some of those people. Hell, it's crossed my mind to go down there and be like, I was assaulted that day. No statute of limitations. It was a felony assault, is what they look like. It's crossed my mind, but other people out there may, you know, it could, maybe that would be helpful. Show the double standard. What are they going to do if they don't take it? And you'll say, "Ha, here you go." Even more blatant hypocrisy. But the thought also occurs that some of these cities, counties, even whole states, what New York is doing to VDARE are just so blatantly
post, I don't want to say post constitution, but post legal principles. They just, they do what they want to do. It's naked political aggression. And our guys, you could just stay the hell out of there. But I'm sure that they would love that. Yes, yes, we prevented the Nazis from ever stepping foot in our state.
No, I mean,
we created such a legal.
You kind of have, you kind of don't have anything to lose at this point. Like, they're making it clear that if you might as well just go in and make a criminal complaint or go in and sue somebody, because if you have cause to, and a lot of people have cause, sure. I mean, people got all kinds of bad. I mean, these pictures are all buried now, but you can find them. If you look, you can find pictures of guys just covered in blue bleach that Antifa was throwing at people to try to blind them. All you people have cause. So yeah, I mean, it could very quickly make this very difficult for Hinckley if a lot of people who actually have cause went in and made complaints.
Yeah, yep. Would have to be qualify as a felony. I don't know all of our guys are perfectly, but you know, if it's nasty enough, I'm certainly sure that qualifies as felony assault. I did you know, I was the one who boosted Free Expression Foundation, Glenn Allen and his great team, the other day, because they're doing a ton of work from Patriot defending our guys. He's appealing Warren Baylog's suit against Charlottesville for obviously First Amendment infringement. So he's doing a ton of good work. I didn't see anything specific to the Torch March cases, but I bet good old Glenn is at least helping out in some way on that. So to the question before, what can you do? Well, hey, consider the Free Expression Foundation. Go to their websites, freeexpressionfoundation.org. I'll link Greg's articles as well and the show notes. They're up at UNS. And I think the originals were, was it Occidental Observer?
Yeah.
Slash quarterly. Yeah, quarterly is the publication. Observer is the website. Almost seven. It'll be 7 years in August. Greg, have you? I think in the aftermath, the greatest tragedy to me, we've said it before, we don't have to beat a dead horse, was that our utter inability to stay united and present a unified front, whether it was through a class action lawsuit or just simply not cucking and saying, oh, what a horrible mistake, we were so stupid, it was a setup. But have you reevaluated your Charlottesville analysis or whether it was quote unquote a mistake or not now?
No, it was freaking awesome. Like, I'm not gonna,
no, all right, like, my man. On. Yeah,
come on.
I had to ask. Yeah,
no, the funny thing is that it seems like the people that were most bitter, or not bitter, the most vociferous in their denouncing of like the intelligence of Charlottesville were the ones who were least hurt by it. It seems like to me, no, it's like, it's the Spangler thing. Like you in history, you can either do what has to be done or you can do nothing. And Amen. You know, if you're a man of action, you're a man of history, you're going to pick the first one, every time, no matter what the outcome.
Yeah. And, you know, I called it half cooked or half baked at the top. And, you know, unfortunately, of course, it was a bit haphazard. It's fair to say the organization was not top notch and a lot of precautions weren't taken. But just that, the
fact was still,
that.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. Yeah. It was still, sorry to interrupt you, but like it was still better than like, it was way better than an American civilian should have to do in order to walk out in the street and say something political. Like the amount the amount of thought, I mean, I've learned this over the years talking to people, like the amount of thought and that went into that. And like, granted, we all know the mistakes and the problems. And these were like organizational problems that are inherent to a bunch of people meeting on the internet and coming together and trying to, you know, do something political. These are going to happen. But the spontaneous organization that actually did occur, I think, is incredible. Like, if it weren't for that, I think you would have had dozens of people killed at Charlottesville. I'm actually shocked. I was shocked the day of that there was not any people, any like NDs, negligent discharges of like rifles and stuff. Because a lot of people there were probably shouldn't have been carrying rifles or pistols. And I mean, I saw one guy in the parking lot and I, like very early in the day, like literally dropping his mag on the ground. I was like, oh, I'm like, man, I guess I'm going to die today.
One of those days. Yeah.
it was bad. Like some of the, like, yeah.
Yeah.
And So what I'm saying is that the overall, it's actually amazing that it didn't, like, way more people didn't get killed.
Yep. Yep. And I'm sure they
and who said, of course, this is all the cops' fault. I mean, that's what this all comes down to. And that kind of one more point I'll throw in here in the overall, like, all these cases and stuff, I think the fundamental problem is that our people do not decide to set a narrative. We allow ourselves to be put into the enemy's narrative. Like, they come at us with, you're all terrorists, and mm-hmm. you wanted to go lynch like a million black people, and that was what you clearly wanted to do. And we're like, whoa, wait a second, we just wanted to like have free speech. That's the wrong answer. The correct answer is, no, you are an illegal RICO conspiracy. You teamed up with the government and with George Soros, mm-hmm. and you are all also, by the way, super rich, super privileged. This is not a bunch of like innocent, just hardworking students like yeah. pulling themselves up by your bootstraps. You're one of the most privileged universities in the country. Don't do this pretense of you guys being like not all the feeder school for the Justice Department and the FBI is ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. It's insulting. So, like, amen, that's why I wrote these articles. I want to people to approach it from that frame, and then all the facts that you start finding start fitting actually and making sense, and it gives you that moral and spiritual power to actually face these people.
Good on you, Greg. I was dead serious at the top when I said you'd be the last person in the world I'd ever suspect to flip, and it was just good to hear the fire still emanating from your belly. And yeah, remember for the audience, a somewhat, you know, haphazard assembly of roughly over 1,000 set the world on its ear for months and now creeping into years. And it was only through deliberate negligence directed from the top and the puppeteers down to the Charlottesville PD and the Virginia State Police that it was a conspiracy to deny us our First Amendment rights. Even if that sounds gay, it's still true. It's probably, you know, it's the scandal of the decade of that decade. So far as I'm
concerned. For sure.
Yep. You steamrolled me at the top there, Prussian socialism host, and I didn't even get to warm up. You just jumped right into it. Good on you. But please, we got to stick to the rules here to a certain extent. Greg, what's your ethnicity, religion, and fatherhood status, please?
All right. Yes. Ethnicity, religion, and fatherhood status. Okay. Can I do that backwards?
As you like.
So I'm not a father. Religion. I'm a national socialist. I mean, I don't know if that qualifies as a religion, but I think Adolf Hitler is absolutely the greatest figure of world history, and that his example, fills me with something like spiritual awe. As far as ethnicity. That's the easy one. That's a fun one. I'm mother's side Sudeten German and father's side Calabrian Italian. Little bits and pieces from the rest of Europe too, but mainly those two, German Italian. I did just read an article about Calabrian genetics, and apparently we are the closest thing to ancient Greeks. So
very cool. Yeah. Well, so I had not heard Calabrian. What's Calabrian? Is what part of Italy?
The toe.
Some island or okay.
No, the toe, right next to Sicily.
That's how you get your good tans. Yep. Very good. Yeah. And were you always like this, Greg? Did you come libertarian, conservative into our worldview, or a brief trip down memory lane? Yeah.
Yeah, so no, I wasn't a libertarian ever. Libertarianism always struck me as preposterous. How could you? It seems to ignore the problem of violence. How you just say that? Well, if we just don't have violence, then we won't have political problems. It's like, well, I mean, yeah, if we had heaven on earth, things would be great. I don't know. I came into it from I was just studied a lot of history, and that gives you a certain awareness of the world, I think. And the thing that really set me over the edge on the Jewish question was reading the essay by Ron Unz, who is himself a Jew. So I guess he, like the Jew who turned me into an anti-Semite, called Myth of the American Meritocracy. And it's a 28 or 30 page article where he lays out piece by piece, this is how we know that Jews are overrepresented in the Ivy League, the main elite institutions. And this is how it's not just a matter of like, even if we want to say that it's just because they're smarter or something, like they're still overrepresented, even if we calculate for IQ, and the people who are totally unrepresented are whites. So from that was November of 2014. So almost 10 years ago. And I read that. And like, I think most people have when it really all comes together for you, because even before then, I understood that the Israeli lobby was powerful. And I understood that that was a Jewish ethnic interest, but I didn't grasp the full extent of it. And that made me grasp the full extent of it. And it's, there were several weeks of like intellectual ecstasy and followed by many months of study and then varying moods of hate to happiness to depression to whatever. And then, you know, slowly things sort of evened out and I decided that I had to do something.
Good for you. Yeah. I was a subscriber to the American Conservative. I think that's where that article came out from Unz about, essentially Jews being extraordinarily overrepresented into these elite institutions, the farm squad for their future control. Let's see here. I had a bunch. Have to ask just for propriety. You were, of course, a founding member of the National Justice Party, which is no more or less. And I'd just be remiss if I didn't ask about it. You were one of the first of the Central Committee to go. And I'm not interested in drudging it up. I'm not searching for sordid scuttlebutt. But I did have to ask and want to give you the chance to say anything if you'd like.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is unfortunate. You know, you can listen to my speech from a year ago, and I mean, essentially those are the problems. And like 95% of what I said, that turns out to be true.
Fair enough.
Perhaps even more. I mean, we'll find out, I guess, as things come out more. But perhaps even, I underestimated the problem.
Right. Yeah, another tragic example of our efforts in America, at least, sort of going.
What it shows, though, is like we need to sort of learn the lessons of society formation again, because you know, one thing that you see with Americans a lot is this notion of like, well, we don't need to have organization, or we don't need to do planning, or we don't need to do set up procedures, because that's all just bureaucracy and that's BS. We don't need to do that. This is like a common, like kind of American attitude. And it's absolutely incorrect. These procedures have evolved, whether they be court systems or legal systems or governments or whatever, have evolved over many centuries since the fall of Rome, really, when Europe was thrown into chaos and like slowly we put together bigger and bigger polities. These things have their place and they have their use. We sort of have the opposite problem of like Germans. I mean, Hitler complains all the time about like Germans being super, being overly officious and wanting to like create committees and create bureaucracy where you didn't need it. Well, that's a German problem. That's how Germans are. We have the opposite problem. So we kind of need to correct ourselves in more into the direction of actually having procedures. And especially right now, what all this really shows, you've got our movement spread out all over the country, many people who believe in the same things, who have the same ideas, even the same general philosophy about how to do things, who don't really know what to do about it. And who are actually, more to the point, who have problems with other groups and other people. And we have no process by which to sort out these problems. The like ancient peoples would have had like a tribal assembly or something, like a folk moot, where they would have had trials or some kind of thing to deal with the problems between the different tribes. We don't even have that right now. So essentially, like any dispute that comes up has to just go into all out war, or I mean not literal like weapons war, but just political like fighting to the maximum extent allowable.
Yeah, I want to say that we're in a better place metapolitically or ideologically than we probably ever have been in terms of the sheer number of people who know the score, aren't afraid to speak up, being able to talk about race, being able to talk about Jews. The Jews, of course, have helped us a ton by their brutality in Palestine. And yet, at the same time, it's hard for me to be optimistic when, you know, it's a proliferation of very small groups, which, you know, that could be useful in terms of not presenting one juicy target, even if the alt-right was dispersed and had many random elements. But it's like winning the war of ideas, but making virtually no progress on organization and political power as well. I want to, you know, mention, of course, Judd Blevins, who won election city of Enid in Oklahoma, and guess who organized a recall of them? Local leftists. They found a milquetoast, middle of the road, you know, granny Republican sort of mayor conspired against him to get her to run. And, you know, he lost just last week, 60-40, which looks bad in terms of an election score, but 40% not bad for a guy who was a Charlottesville veteran. Of course, but you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I can take the white pill on the 40%, but at the same time, they
organized. Yeah, but But did he run as a Charlotte? Did he say, "I'm a Charlottesville veteran, and this is what we need to do"? I don't count that. I mean, come on.
We don't have many of our guys running for office. So it's a significant data point, as you know.
If you're not upfront like that when you run for office, how do you expect to actually implement any kind of program that we would actually want implemented? It's like everyone talks about this big game about getting into office or getting into a government bureaucracy and doing good things. And like, I've yet to see one example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't cuck. He wasn't like, you know, holding a tiki torch on the campaign trail. He sort of split the difference. He did, of course, get elected, but it was sort of like lurking in the background. And then they made it the central focus. They brought in the NBCs and the HuffPos, et cetera, to focus in on him. And I think they essentially spooked the horses and also and just, you know, turned out the rabid ideologues on their own side as well. Going into November 2024, Greg, you are obviously a very smart, well-read guy. Do you have a preferred outcome? I'm sure that Biden-Trump is below you in terms of interest or enthusiasm, but which one do you think would be better for us as white people in America in the long term?
So, yeah, the basic answer, you got the woke thing going on. So the basic answer is, well, Trump would be better because Biden's bad. The next answer is, well, Biden would be better because if Trump gets into office, we see this sort of cyclical thing where when the Republican is in office, there's like more crazy leftist, like Antifa riots. I mean, I haven't seen, we haven't had a proper Antifa riot since 2020 and last time Trump was in office. But on the other hand, like, I almost want to say Trump because I think white nationalists need the pressure in order to hurry up and get things in order. So, like, worse is better almost, because to use the expression, you know, lights a fire under your ass.
Sure.
But this election, I don't vote. Like, I'm not going to vote. I think voting is immoral and a waste of time, and it's getting your buy-in with the system. So I don't really have a sophisticated opinion on it. I just, yeah, it's whatever. But that's not to say don't be political. Like this, like you mentioned earlier, the Palestine thing, like the environment right now is great. People are realizing what the problem is.
I know Israel, top of the Wall Street Journal, just before we went to tape, I did spring Shame on Me for a Wall Street Journal subscription because I was so damn tired of wanting to read their stuff across the board and getting paywalled out. But yeah, Israel more isolated than in decades. Excuse me. And you cannot open Twitter is just like a ratio massacre. Like every politician, every shill, like, you know, Joe Pepe is like, screw Israel. And he gets like 5,000 likes. And like, you know, the good goy or the blatant Jew is just like completely silenced. And of course, you know, they make that all out to be Elon Musk is a Nazi or whatever. But it's just that the hoi polloi have slipped their chains. For real. And you look at these accounts and they're not Groypers. They're not all like, you know, Waffen 88 friend. They're like a lot of like regular people, many under their real names and faces, just saying, no, F off. We don't believe your lies anymore. Screw you. No more weapons. You're not our greatest ally. It's really heartening to see. And frankly, it reminds me of our, you know, sort of upswing 2015, 26, 2017, when the information war really started raging. Greg, America today, do you see it as more pre-Yugoslavia breakup, pre-Soviet dissolution, pre-NSDAP ascension, or pre-Bolshevik revolution? I'm springing that one on you, but any historical analogies that you think are most apt for where we are?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about, I think we're in Rome about 120 BC.
Oh, wow. we got that long to go, huh? Or you think, yeah. Or you're talking about, or you're looking forward to Caesar arriving, not the.
All right, we're looking forward to okay. Exactly, yeah, exactly. We're looking forward to Caesar arriving. So
I was looking forward to 440 or 420, whatever it was, you know, Alaric.
No, I think I hope I'm wrong. I hope it isn't 100 years of civil wars. I'm certainly not planning for 100 years of civil wars. I would prefer to see a national revolution in our lifetimes. So, you know, more of a Hitler style revolution, I think would be great. But, I mean, I guess the Black Hill version is, yeah, that it's the analogies of us to Rome. If you read about Roman history in like the late hundreds or early, first century BC, it's just uncanny, the parallels.
Good stuff. Have you ever seriously considered moving back to the motherland, either Germany or Italy, regardless of the logistics or whether you could? Does that hold appeal for you, or are you this is my land and I'm dying here?
I won't deny that there's some appeal there, but I do think America is the Schwerpunkt, the point of main effort in all of world politics. So, you know, as much as we all have a sort of adventurous spirit about us, that it seems fun to go around the world or go to different countries or go back to the European homeland. It's like, well, this is what matters right here in America, because America obviously controls, is controlled by Jews, and through America, the Jews control Western Europe and Australia and New Zealand and Canada and all the third world as well.
The thought occurs, I'm so used to Sam hopping in with questions. I hope he is not sitting there crying into his beer because I busted his chops. No. listening. Sam, and any, I got one or two more for Gregor before we hit the break, but I just wanted to, kick the tires. No, what do you think? What do you think about all
this? Yeah, very good. I mean, Greg is very comprehensive in his answers. I unmuted a couple times, ready to jump in, but then he would kind of go right where I was thinking. So yeah, the court system in this country is, you cannot expect justice. The law in this country is arbitrary. It's arbitrarily enforced. And I think many people that went to Charlottesville were very idealistic, which is good, of course. But now you've learned what maybe some of us knew already. You know, I've seen injustice after injustice through the years. It's the fact of where we are. So working through the courts, fighting in the courts, that's a tough one. You know, not that it shouldn't be tried, but you have to understand that what we're up against. You know, if you fight in the courts, it's to try to set a precedent. It's to try to get attention, things like that. Like you say, coach, all the myriad of groups, there's a splintering of groups. There's many groups. Mm-hmm. It's not that there are not nationalists, but we are splintered. Just speaking for our own local group here, I think the idea is we're trying to form a community that something can spring from later. You know what I mean? We have to have cohesion with each other. We have to have family with each other. And in time, the next steps will become apparent. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell anybody what to do. But I do know that unless we have each other, you know, there was an old National Socialist saying, if we have each other, then we have everything. So that's what we have to work on. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Sammy, baby. Yeah. Greg, another one I got to ask. You knew him better than almost any of us. And perhaps the question's even flawed in conception, but what the hell happened to Spencer to have him turn into like a neoliberal contrarian lickspittle? Is it just sour grapes, you know, like these stupid problems
didn't stick with me? No. I think it's very simple. Richard has the sort of addiction to the hot take. I think that's, I haven't talked to him in years, so I don't know, but that would be my guess is he's addicted to the hot take. And so, you know, he likes getting a rise out of people.
Yeah. When I scroll his Twitter and see him mocking V-Dare for getting Lawfare to death and the NATO logo up top, I'm like, okay, if you want to, be that guy that makes everyone hate you.
Yeah, well, it's like if you're gonna fanboy somebody like Macron, like come on, you know, I've been fanboying Hitler, but you know, Hitler's I feel is worthy of my fanboying, so I don't.
Is it really a hot take addiction? Because it seems like he's looking for the coldest take because everyone else is looking for a hot take.
Well, it's one of those things that the take is so hot that it's cold.
I guess that's
the other way around, maybe.
The dry ice take.
Yeah, there you go. It's so cold that it's hot again. Comes back around to being hot. Isn't Macron married to a man? Has that been? That's been kind of the
no.
He's married to his middle school teacher.
Yes, he just but it's a man with men. No. It was an old crone that lured him into her gingerbread house, but he has sex with black men on the side.
Well, she looks like Iggy Pop in a wig. Yeah. Ooh, yeah, really cute. Last one for you, Greg, here at the top. At least you're welcome to stay with us in the second hour. If you got to run, you got to run. That's fine. Russia, Ukraine, way too big to devote too much time to it here. You also are a fellow Russia appreciator. And it certainly appears that they are about to kick some serious ass this summer with a major offensive. Are you a Putin respecter? Do you view Russia as the better of the two parties there? Do you have sympathies for the Ukrainian NatSox? Do you have that?
No. You set that question up well. It's the Ukraine is like, this is the South Tyrol question of American nationalism. So, for any listeners who don't know, the South Tyrol issue.
I know
you guys know, but like, it was the issue of back in the 1920s, this part of the Alps had been allocated to Italy, formerly used to be part of Austria, and it had a lot of mostly German speakers in it. And so all the German nationalists would get angry at Hitler because Hitler thought that Germany ought to ally with Italy and that they ought to just handle the South Tyrol question by moving the Germans out of South Tyrol and to appease the Italians because Italy was more important to you strategically. And so it like basically because Hitler had the overall strategic vision of what Germany had to do, long term, it made him enemies in the short term. He could have taken the easy way out and just said, oh, yeah, you know, screw those Italians. And like, how dare they tread on German nationalists, Germans in the South Tyrol. He could have been a demagogue. That's what a demagogue would have done. Hitler wasn't a demagogue. Hitler was a sound politician and a real leader. So, you know, on Ukraine, yes, you are right to say that I'm a Russia respecter, I guess. I've in the sense, not in the political sense, but like I've studied Russian. That was my major in school. I've been to Russia. But no, I view the key takeaway, the simplest takeaway on the Ukraine question is how does this matter for my people? And then, I mean, that presupposes who are my people. Well, my people are whites who live in America and Western Europe and you know, other white diaspora countries. Russia are not my people. And that's not to say that I don't like Russians or that I hate them or something. They're genetically, obviously, you know, we're racially the same or, you know, similar. But Russia is, I think, a different civilization from ours. And even if it is a different civilization, it's certainly a different geostrategic entity. And I do not want unification with white Russians, or sorry, I guess that has a special meaning in the context of Eastern Europe. Ethnic Russians, yeah, I don't want unity with them, because if we wanted unity with them, that would necessarily mean that we want to break up the Russian Federation. And that would necessitate war with Russia, which I don't think is in our interests. So what's in our interest? What's in the interest of whites? Our interest is in pointing out that this war, like the war in Palestine, is totally to the advantage of the Jews and the military-industrial complex. We have no interest as whites in the West in supporting this war. And in fact, if we're going to be angry at anybody, we should be angry at our own elites. This is just yet another proof that our elites are evil and incompetent. So as regards, like, yeah, I mean, Zelensky is a puppet. Putin is an outside guy. He runs his own country. And, you know, we can talk about Putin as like a historical figure, but I don't say like, oh, I admire Putin or something as a political actor that I don't want to be like friends with him or want to shape policy based on a personal liking of him or not dislike of him. He's a political actor who needs to be dealt with as such.
Yeah, I would say that good and friendly, cordial, professional relations with Russia, if you are actually worried about the Chaikoms, is probably the single most important strategic consideration for the United States, if it's going to remain a going concern. I always considered Russians like very distant, you know, long lost cousins who sort of wandered off there and chose that as their homeland. I still consider them part of the white family of peoples for sure, but you're absolutely correct that they are absolutely a horse of a different color, a different breed. They think differently. And all of it, essentially. We could probably do an entire show on that, which would be a lot of fun to do. To go to the break, Greg has a massive surprise in store. You're never going to guess the musical genre that he is going to take us out to this week.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Coach, if I might interject one more thing. Oh, I forgot to say,
absolutely.
I need to, before we go to the break, I need to shill my book. So.
Yes. Shame on me. Yeah.
I wrote a book called Sieg Heil, German for Beginners. It's a introductory German language textbook for, well, people that don't want to read the boring textbooks that you usually read. And you want to read the exciting stuff about Nazis, which I think is what every middle school and high school boy wants to do. This is the textbook for you. So it's coming out in, we're looking at late May with Invisible Empire Publishers.
Awesome. Will there be a link that I can put in the show notes, or we'll just stay tuned for it?
Not yet. Yeah. You'll just have to keep your eyes closed for that. So that'll be,
I feel much better. I thought that maybe I missed it. And I was like, how the hell did I miss Greg's book? Good on you, buddy. I remember hearing you were working on it. Also for the audience, check out Prussian Socialism. I've heard lots of good things about it. I've listened to an episode or two, but I've been shamefully non-listening to a lot of content recently, sort of in keeping with my laissez-faire attitude towards things, the movement. And Greg did a lot of work. Check out his articles on Seville. Support the Free Expression Foundation. Read Greg's stuff. And whatever you do, stay informed, stay in touch, and never give up hope. Greg, what are we going to be listening to at the break here, please, buddy? And thanks for coming on.
All right, thanks for having me, Coach.
All right, what's the tune?
Oh, it's Svavats. It's the Hitlerjugend anthem.
Is that forward? Hitlerjugend
anthem. Yeah, yeah. Forward, forward.
I figured. Half a semester of German over satellite in high school. Shame on me too. All right, thanks everybody. We will be right back.
Vorwärts, vorwärts, mitten die hellen Fanfaren. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Jugend kennt keine Gefahren. Deutschland, du wirst leuchtend stehen, mögen wir auch untergehen. Vorwärts, vorwärts, schmettern die hellen Fanfaren. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Jugend kennt keine Gefahren. Ist das Ziel auch noch so hoch? Jugend zwingt es doch.
Unsere Fahne, Land an uns voran. In die Zukunft sehen wir Mann für Mann. Wir marschieren, wir gehen da durch Nacht und durch Mut. Mit der Fahne der Jugend für Freiheit und Mut. Unsere Fahne flattert uns voran. Unsere Fahne ist die neue Zeit. Und die Fahne führt uns in die Ewigkeit. Ja, die Fahne ist mehr als der Tod.
Wir sind der Zukunft Soldaten, Jugend, Jugend, Träger der kommenden Taten. Ja, durch unsere Fäuste fällt, wer sich uns entgegenstellt. Jugend, Jugend, wir sind der Zukunft Soldaten, Jugend, Jugend, Träger der kommenden Taten. Höre, wir gehören dir, wir Kameraden dir.
Unsere Fahne flattert uns voran. In die Zukunft ziehen wir Mann für Mann. Wir marschieren gerichtlich durch Nacht und durch Not. Mit der Fahne der Jugend für Freiheit und Mut. Unsere Fahne flattert uns voran. Unsere Fahne ist die neue Zeit. Und die Fahne führt uns in die
Welcome back to Full House episode 183, Greg Conte, Charlottesville, and more edition. Hope you enjoyed that first half. You better have. I did for sure. And here we are. And of course, forward, forward, which I will be blasting into my skull at about 200 decibels shortly after we conclude this recording. We've got a lot of disparate items to discuss here in the second half. We'll see if Greg throws us any curveballs. But I guess we'll just start with New White Life and get right to it. And our pal Gierick welcomed his and his wife, of course, welcome their fourth. Congratulations. She deserves the Order of the German Mother Cross for sure. Yeah. I think he may have been shopping for it. And Gierick, the nice guy, said he gives 50% credit to the Full House gang for helping to guilt us into revising our decision to be done at three. Hell yeah, buddy. I certainly hope the fourth is not a total hellion that makes you regret revisiting your plans. You know what they say, the last one is always the worst because it's the last one. So maybe they'll go for five if number four is a beautiful, I forget if it was a boy or a girl, maybe that was deliberate. But congratulations all the same, guys. I wish we had four, and we probably would have if we started earlier. Not that you need that dead horse to be beaten. And our pal Marty also welcomed, I want to say it was seven, Sam. He's got a big, beautiful family.
Yeah, I think he wonderful. Entered
the realm of Sam, the Order of Sam. super, super happy about it. Never met Marty, just a stranger on the internet who, what do you know, comes across as a kind, smart, competent, and fecund fellow. Marty, congratulations to you and your
great
wife too. Good luck. Yes. Get Sam on speed dial if you ever pull your head out.
Yeah.
With seven. Wanted to talk a little bit about Easter, which is rare for me personally, because we did go up to visit my parents, which we do every once in a while. Sometimes they come down here, we go up there. But this year, in the past, I would never say, let's go to church or let's get the kids to church. But it was Easter. My mom is still a devout church going every Sunday Catholic. And I, one, wanted to make her happy, just to be perfectly candid. Two, I wanted the kids to get the experience of what I had so often growing up. And I'll be honest, I wanted them to either appreciate the grandeur and the ceremony and perhaps be inspired by it, or understand how, frankly, kind of a little bit tedious and inscrutable it can be. If it went either way, it was fine. Maybe for one of the kids, it would be an inspiration and they would want to start going. Or maybe for another one, they'd be like, this sucks. And thanks, Dad, for not making us go to church on Sunday. Now, interesting, Sam. This is my old parish that I went to CCD for, God knows, you know, over a decade. Got confirmed there. And the priest was African, sub-Saharan African, not South African Boer. Both altar boys were black teenagers. The assistant priest was a high caste castizo of some type. I'm going to guess, I don't know, Venezuelan or Colombian, could have been Central American, more or less a white Spaniard. But that was that. Potato was perfectly behaved. Audience knows I've sometimes ragged on him as being our most difficult, but he was silent. He stood, he kneeled, he did everything on cue. The older two did look like I had put them in the Iron Maiden. They were not pleased to be there. And I tried, and here's the other thing, Sam, even when I was a kid, like I'd try to pay attention unless we had the really good priests with, or really good priest singular with a good homily that I could actually follow along with and stay engaged, you know, good public speaker, relevant to the reading from the Bible, but also relevant to today's world. And this African priest almost did a little bit of clap back, black church style, where he was like, when I say hallelujah, you say amen. It wasn't too bad. I mean, he was dignified, right? I could understand what he was saying. He had a very thick accent somewhere West Africa. I don't know, Nigeria or something like that.
Baltimore or something.
But when I looked, I really thought that I was going to see some of my old friends or neighbors or like friends, parents or something. I didn't recognize a single person in the pews. And this was Easter Sunday. So that tells me something. I'm pretty sure that not all of my old Catholic, you know, buddies and parents, you know, left the church, but I suspect they may have gone to a different parish because they weren't interested in that or how things are going. All in all, though, I'm glad that I went. I didn't grill the kids. I said, what did you think of the experience? And the older two were like, you know, kind of sucked, Dad. And the youngest one was pretty chipper about it. He said, it was okay. He sat between me and my mom. It was worth doing. It was heartfelt, but not a home run in terms of converting them to the faith. What do you think, Sam?
Well, I will concur with you in this sense. I can remember back to the early 90s. As an adult, I had really given up on the Catholic Church. And when I started having children, we would attempt to come back at times and be turned off to it. Honestly, at this time, we were already fully engaged in white nationalism. So I don't need to go into all that. But then about 1994 or into 95 is when we were introduced to the traditional Tridentine Latin Mass. And we were involved in the homeschooling movement in the area. And within the homeschooling movement, there was a movement within the movement of these trad Caths that had their own private traditional mass with their own private priest. So we got invited to that. And when we had backtrack for a moment, when we would occasionally try to go to just a regular mass, the kids, they would act up, or they would not like it, or it would not be a positive experience. But right. when we went to the traditional mass, there's something about it, the majesty, the dignity, the solemnity of it, the grandeur, a quiet sense of joy that the children were perfectly behaved during it. And I've already recounted all this before, so I won't say it in great detail, but from really the first time we attended the traditional mass, we knew we had to do this, you know, and since that time, we did do it. And in the late 90s, I became an altar server myself. And through the years, we've always attended traditional mass. And my youngest son, he became an altar server. We later served together. I became a server again. But we always enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. It's a more spiritual experience, mystical, if you will say. But
I've never been to one, yeah, so I can't even compare.
Well, you know, there's one in I don't know if I should say the town, but it's maybe 30 minutes from you. Well, in Winchester, you know, when I was out there, it seemed like when I looked on whatever day it was, I looked to see on the GPS and it said something like 45 minutes. But when we actually drove there, it was less than 45 minutes on a Sunday morning. Anyways,
we'll say West Winchester. Yeah. You were leaving.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, and it was kind of a modernist kind of a church, but the mass was lovely. And I would recommend going to it sometime if you're ever curious or you want a little different experience. But as far as for Easter, of course, my new daughter-in-law was here. So I made baskets for everyone. You know, that's our thing. I make the baskets and I put candy and different things in there. And so that was a nice experience for her. And as I make the baskets for the whole family. And then I hide the baskets, you know, and you got to go find them somewhere in the house. But it was a very nice day. And we ended up doing a cookout because with all the people here and everything like that, it sometimes just makes a lot of mess inside. So we made the mess outside and made it easier for everybody. And it was kind of a cold day, really. We've had some very cold days here and even snow showers, couple between now and then. So but it was a very nice day.
Good stuff. I forgot to say that the Easter Bunny came too, of course. We still have Easter Bunny respecter. And what we did was there was some anxiety because, you know, our property, Sam, Easter egg hunts here are pretty epic. And our youngest was very concerned that the Easter Bunny would come here and not to Grandma and Grandpa. So he wrote a letter to the Easter Bunny. And I said, I don't know. I've never written a letter to the Easter Bunny before. I'm familiar with one Arctic Circle, North Pole. So we wrote a little letter to let him know that where we were going to be. And we sent it to Easter Island, which touched me.
There you go.
And lo and behold, we had a lovely Easter egg hunt. And then the other thing is we went to the Philadelphia Zoo after mass.
Wait, why would you take your kids to a prison?
But we went to the actual zoo, the America's first zoo, which I remember liking as a kid. And let me tell you, it was 90% non-white with a significant
behind the bars.
The weirdest thing was there was a large Jewish contingent there, and they were the whitest. They were Orthodox. They had the kippahs on. They didn't have the curlicues, but they were the whitest looking Jews that I've ever seen. Like blue eyes, pale skin, and not even the classic phenotype, but clearly observant Jews. I could tell it about them even without the kippahs on. But that was very strange. But it just reminded me, I said, holy moly. I mean, obviously the Philadelphia Zoo is not in the best neighborhood. It's always had a large black contingent, but it was really, really non-white. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, Coach, you didn't take your kids to the Kensington neighborhood, did you?
I wanted to. I was like, scared Mom,
straight. Yeah. Like a scared straight experience.
I know. I was like, don't worry, Mom. I'll bring my self-defense item. And don't you even think about that. We're not going to Kensington and you're not bringing that. All right. Fine. We'll play
to see the zombies.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I wanted to ask Greg, were you raised? You must have been raised Catholic. Did you reject it or did it never take for you?
No, I wasn't really raised Catholic. I mean, no. I guess we went to church occasionally, but I wasn't raised Catholic.
Because you were a substitute teacher, and was it a Catholic girls' school or was it just private?
Yeah, that's a good point. I went to Jesuit college, Georgetown, which I mean is kind of a stretch because it really is not religious at all.
Not really Catholic. Yeah.
It's satanic, really.
To say the least.
Yeah, and then coaching at all the girls' Catholic school. Yeah, I mean they don't even ask you like, are you Catholic? It's just
Greg, you didn't have to hit anybody's knuckles with a ruler, did you?
No, I definitely was not allowed to.
Greg would give them a little smack on the fanny if they.
I just make them do. I just yell at them, make them do push-ups and stuff.
Yeah. When Greg, when you got interviewed, whatever it was, NBC, CBS, you know, the epic, like smoking a cigar with the scarf around your shoulders, you look like you were so happy and so in your element when that happened. Was there actually like, are you actually human? Were you nervous or like a little upset about that happening? Or were you like, thank you, God, for finally liberating me?
Well, I mean, it was kind of great because it's like, I mean, all these people I'd known for years, like they knew, like they didn't know that I was at Charlottesville, but like they knew, they knew that this is an educated, smart guy who it has common sense, which all of those things, you put them together, you get Nazi. So yeah, they knew. I mean, sort of like an intuitive sense. I think, you know, and women are very good at intuition. So I think they kind of were like, yeah. I mean, I used to get jokes all the time, like, oh, Coach Conti, why do you like Hitler? Yeah. Like they would like deduce this themselves or not into it, I guess. And I would just be like, whatever made you think that?
So how much time you got? Yeah.
So yeah, when it finally kind of just came out, it's like, I got to just be myself and everyone, you know, it's like, all right, now we're on the same page. Okay, good.
One of many epic memes over the year, Greg enjoying a good stogie out front, talking to the news lady as casual as can be. Social announcement, or I guess public service announcement for the audience. Of course, the solar eclipse, the big solar eclipse is coming tomorrow, Monday, 2 p.m., 3 p.m. East Coast time. I guess it's going to be a cloudy one. I still have one pair of Celestron solar eclipse shades from the 2017 one. I went down to the mall, National Mall, that day to see it, and it was kind of a damp squib. I wasn't terribly impressed. I guess you have to be like to experience totality to get the full climax of the solar eclipse. But Sam and I are sort of on the margins of getting a good view on it, and it's supposed to be cloudy. So the kids are getting out of school 3 hours early. They shut it down, I guess, because the timing didn't work out and they didn't want kids sticking their heads out of the bus and getting decapitated by a tree branch. So all the kids are getting out of school early tomorrow. We're going to go to the highest hill that we can find here. And I guess maybe I'll do some last minute shopping. I don't even know if they have shades yet, but go out and check it out. Even if it's a half or a quarter or two thirds, whatever, might be fun. And having a beautiful day here, my ass was totally dragging because tax day is around the corner too, April 15th. I've been ready to go for a long time, but was waiting on one document. So last night I said, screw that document. I got to know whether I'm going to be paying or whether I'm going to get paid out. So I stayed up. I do this every year where I just assemble. I've got everything assembled. I finally sit down on my computer, and it usually takes me about 3 or 4 hours to do it thoroughly. So I did that last night. I said, show be damned, good weather be damned. Got that done at 4 o'clock, and then I was up at 9 o'clock, and I said, nope, this is not one of those days where I'm going back to sleep. Got to get out there, plant trees, change the oil on the rider mower, and change the air filter, gassed her up. I did have to jump the battery. It had died over the winter. I I gave up starting it during the winter to charge up the battery. I was like, I'll just jump it in the spring. And then my old push mower was being a real stubborn mule. She would start and then immediately shut down. I think it had something to do with the air filter. I sprayed a little WD-40 in there because the one time I mowed Smasher's yard, he had a mower that wouldn't stay on unless you sprayed carb cleaner into that air filter section. And at like the 12th or 13th attempt at it starting, running, shutting down, it just stayed on. So I don't know what the hell mechanically that was. I ordered new air filters for it, but just a little bit of lawn autism and satisfaction of firing up the mower. And as I was cruising around on that mower, somebody said recently, I don't know who it was, but said some of my best thinking. For some guys, it's on the can. For other guys, it's in the shower. And for other men, it's cruising the seas of emerald grass when you get your good thinking doing it. And I got excited to do the show with Greg tonight, which talking about the show, I wanted to broach this. I talked a little bit with Sam Arolo about it, but we all know that our interest and disinterest in our cause, et cetera, varies according to how our individual lives are going, how the movement is going, what the news is doing to us, whether we're ecstatic, despondent, or somewhere in between. But we are coming up on 5 years of Full House. Our first show was actually April 19th or April 20th of 2019. And mentally, I'll be candid, I thought after 5 years of doing a podcast, yeah, it hasn't been every week, but a lot of times it's been close to it, close to 200 episodes. Maybe that would be time to hang up the spikes and move on to something else, or just return to a bit of normalcy. And I'll be honest with the audience. I was kind of bummed that after getting at least a dozen requests to do more garden shows, and I think delivering very spectacularly with three expert guests last week, that the numbers on the downloads weren't great. We didn't get a lot of feedback like, hey, thanks for this tip, thanks for that tip. It was kind of quiet, and that bummed me out. But then I also realized, like, I haven't been listening to anything else either. And I think Cantwell provided some commentary about feeling a little bit like, what are we really doing here, guys? And other people have shared the same, that we're sort of just in a phase where the election's looming, we're going about our lives. But I did want to seriously posit the, you know, possibility, or the, I'm not going to cancel the show on April 20th. But we're probably not going to do it forever. I can't see myself doing Full House for another decade. That's hard to envision. But Sam, Rollo, maybe even Greg, about the cruel vicissitudes of podcasting and the moods that we go through, and the feeling like we're doing really good, valid, hard, honest work that is helping change people's lives. We know that is true. And then you look at, like, you know, Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens and Joe Rogan getting, you know, millions upon millions of eyeballs for kind of stuff that is either not that interesting or terrible. Certainly not.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. Yeah. And I'll be the first to admit, like, I'm not a master marketer or whatever. I'm like, we're going to put out a good product, and there's the RSS link, and here's the website. And if you subscribe, great. If not, you know, I tried, but I'm certainly, you know, I'm not boosting on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and all that stuff. But Rollo, give me some of your thoughts first. I know Sam has some, but I'm curious what you think about whether when do we pull the plug? Do we keep doing this in perpetuity until some crisis? It's a pretty forever. Good track record, 5 years. Yeah. Oh, forever. I was afraid you were going to say that.
But then why'd you ask me?
My rock, Sam and Rollo. Just keep doing it. All right.
Well, I'm serious. I mean, you do it until you win. You do it till you don't need to do it anymore. And then when we win, we turn it into something else.
Well, I don't need to do this anymore.
Don't lie to me. Don't lie to me. You need it.
I would hate myself.
I keep you away from that noose, and you know it. Every day you call me, like, I don't know if I can do it. I can't go. I'm like, the people need you. And you're like, you're right. I'll put the bottle of pills down. And I'm like, those aren't pills. Those are M&Ms.
Go ahead, Sam.
Well, we have received such tremendous feedback through the years, and it has happened many times where we get a great letter from somebody and one of us says, and we all agree, if this was the only letter we ever got like this, it would be worth doing the show. All the trouble, the getting doxxed, the being threatened, whatever troubles we've had to go through and whatever it takes to do this show, it would be worth it. And I agree with that. That things are always hitting a home run or you're always getting that dopamine hit. I think you cannot rely on that. Yeah. It's just like a marriage or something like that. It's something you got to keep doing just because it's the right thing to do. And I think that because we've had such great shows and, you know, that great feedback and stuff like that, maybe you're always trying to recapture that high of a certain thing. But I think that even when it's been the two or three of us just chatting about things that we care about issues or things that happen, even when it's the most low key of shows, I think some of those shows have been among the best shows, given the feedback anyways. So I think that, if you're attaching too much weight in a way to like what you have to do, I'd say, you know, try not to put it on such a pedestal. It's something that we do for a couple hours a week. We have fun. We have fun talking to each other. We have fun doing the show and people definitely get a lot out of it. And, you know, try to not see it as such a gigantic investment of time or effort. And it's just something we can easily keep doing. You know, it's like a workout. You know, I work out every day and I make my workout such that I can never have the excuse that I don't have time to do it, you know, and make it where it's something that is worth doing, but not so much drudgery or anything like that. And if you can look at things like that, then of course you're going to keep doing it, you know? So
yeah,
that's all I got to say.
Thank you for that.
Well, you also can't stop until I have at least 6 children. So,
all right. You get I'm taking engagement, Rollo. You get engaged, and that's it. That's our celebratory last show. I'm kidding. But you know, I want to get Greg in here too because he's been through a lot. Obviously, ups, downs, the cruelties, and the sweet victories. But you know, my life has changed so much. Like the kids are getting older. I'm blessedly in a place in some of the rarefied places in the country where you can more or less live and you're not confronted daily with the agitations of hyperdiversity and liberalism. You know, if I shut out the world, obviously the problems don't go away. They keep plugging there and all hands on deck and all that stuff. But I'm 43, the kids are getting older. I feel like we've talked about so much. And I'm just not as angry and heated and motivated as I used to be, which was partially a consequence of being in such close proximity to all of the perils and dangers and menaces that so many of us in the audience around the world face on a daily basis. So I'm absolutely not, you know, stroking my own ego, haha, look at me, I escaped it all. But it's just a reality. We've talked about that in the past. Gregor, I always call you Gregor. I don't know why. Do you occasionally have to like kick yourself in the ass to stay committed, or is it actually okay? So it's not just like naturally coming to you to be, I meant that sincerely, you know, a stalwart, brave, combatant. Nonviolent combatant in our cause.
Yeah, definitely have to, you know, force yourself to do it sometimes or motivate yourself. You know, one thing I find is like something that kind of when I'm sort of drifting and feeling out of it, I take a few days or a couple weeks to really dig into something that I love, like history or languages, and then just read a lot or you know, think about it a lot, or you know, watch movies or something that's really grounds me in that like culture that, you know, I've had with me since I was a kid and been interested in since I was a kid. That kind of like that I always feel like gets me kind of recharged. I don't know, I guess call that kind of a maybe for a lot of people it's religion or something, but that's what does it for me.
Fair enough. Yeah, because when I go and lurk and scroll Twitter, you know, it's heartening to see so many of our guys still out there doing the work. And, you know, to paraphrase from Stalin, how many divisions has the ratio master? You know, not many, but it's still, you know, inspiring, I guess. But it's like, I don't need to see, like, you know, witty commentary repackaged.
Like Telegram and Twitter and 4chan, all these things, like, I do get the, like, if you look at them too much, you start to get a sort of feeling of soul sickness. So yeah. It's, I find it's better to just like read Wikipedia, or if you're, you know, messing around looking at your phone, it's like better to just find some interesting thing and just go off and read a bunch of articles to kill time. If that's what you need to do, rather than like scrolling Twitter, trying to get that like fix of, oh, that's really interesting. Oh, it's about to go down. It's happening.
It never is.
Yeah. The one time I think in like our lifetimes where something actually happened, well, there was like maybe four J6? Times. Like the J6, Russians invading Ukraine, the 2020 riots, COVID, and like Charlottesville. Yeah. Okay, that's like five there.
That's a pretty good tempo, right? Yeah.
It is. Yeah. But it's not, you know, that high gets you through what, about a week? I mean, I remember when the invasion happened. I was like, I spent about a week just like staring at videos and like chatting with friends and stuff. And then you kind of were like, oh, it's yet more kind of just nothing.
Yeah, maybe if the Iranians could really put a new lift in our sails, if they actually follow through on revenge for their
these Middle East, these Saracens are, they're always talking a big game, and then they love to go out there and talk big like Saddam or something, and then they don't really follow through. I don't want to be too down on the Saracens, because that October 7th thing with the flying lawnmowers and everything, that was cool. I gotta say, that was really something.
You gotta wonder if Hamas, if this went according to, because you know they're not dummies. I'm sure they like gamed it out, and they're like they are probably going to invade Gaza and wreck a lot of things and kill a lot of us if we do this. And I'm sure they figured that this might be the triggering point that it would either get Hezbollah or Iran involved, or would further alienate Israel. I mean, I don't know what their calculation was, because certainly Gaza has been ripped to shreds.
I think they just calculated like, this is going to be bad, but we have to do this. Like,
yeah.
And I think they clearly got training in Iran, I think. I mean, I don't
some
think
of, you're some able. Of them, some of them, for sure.
You're not going to be able to pull off an operation of that, like that sophisticated. Like, how do you teach the guys how to fly like those little things without going to Iran? You can't really do it in Gaza, right? I mean, you know,
it's just my new tour company. I'm going to do paragliding. Yeah, Gaza paraglider tours.
What if the Chinese taught them? Because the Chinese have a lot to gain. I'm being serious. I would entertain that.
Okay, but somewhere. They had to go somewhere to get that training. And, I mean, I would be very interested one day to see a historian write a book about the planning process of that. Because I think however they figured out what they did on October 7th is, like, probably the most interesting, like, military history since, like, Moltke or something.
Yeah, and if I were
China, I would be training Israel's enemies to do that shit, because everyone's looking at Iran. So China could, I mean, they have so much of a presence in Africa anyway. It probably wouldn't be too hard for them to just, you know, go to other parts. Like, oh, they're just doing their capitalism here and there, and just they have the most to gain from a massive war, because they have probably the biggest chance for having a control over the global economy if the U.S. tanks.
Yeah, I wonder about the theory that Israel knew it was coming and let it happening to provide them the pretext. You know, 9/11 enabled us to go into Iraq and Afghanistan, and October 7th enabled them to go in and really wreck Gaza. But by all accounts, it certainly looks like that has backfired both on Netanyahu politically, on Israel in particular, in global opinion, and then just the, you know, the metastasis of people connecting Judaism to Israel quite rationally, despite the best efforts of American Jews and stuff to separate the religion from the people, from Zionism, from Israel. Bullshit, essentially. Different sides of the same shekel. They're all in cahoots and they're doing a PR game. But it doesn't really, the only thing that would matter is if this devolves to a regional war, or if Israel actually gets cut off from her American patron in terms of weapons and the aid and stuff like that. And, you know, if you go back just a week or two ago, you know, they were talking about possibly cutting off arms and weapon shipments to Israel. And then like 3 or 4 days later, they just announced a new one that just appeared out of thin air. So I would be shocked if in our lifetimes, the United States suddenly ceased materially supporting the state of Israel, regardless of whatever the hell they do in Gaza. It's just, it's too intertwined. And Russia certainly doesn't appear to be, you know, Cold War style waiting in the wings to sweep in like they did in Egypt when Nasser suddenly was not getting the support from America that he hoped he would get. I doubt China would be interested in becoming Israel's new patron, and actually isolated and cut off Israel from its, you know, leech opportunities would be wonderful to see, and totally surprising too. There's just no prospect in the near term of America cutting them off. Greg, do you see Russia, Iran, China, North Korea as a formidable geopolitical force, or do you think the whole BRICS thing is inflated and both the United States and its European vassals have a lot more gas in the tank? I don't think that Putin wants to bite off. I don't think Putin wants to bite off more than Ukraine, you know, especially despite all the stuff about Poland and stuff like that. What's interesting is what's going on in Romania and stationing troops in Moldova and possibly going to try to save Odessa as a Ukrainian port for some rump Ukrainian state. Yeah.
You see, I haven't heard any of this stuff. I mean, there's Transdniestria is in the way, though, so that'll be interesting.
Yeah,
between Moldova and Odessa.
True. Yep. I think we don't have to get Spenglerian here necessarily. I did try to read Decline of the West, and I kind of fell asleep, and I didn't pick it up again. But it does feel like we're in the death throes of Western civilization, slowly but surely, and that the emerging coalition, you know, sort of nascent natural allies just by virtue of being hated by America, Russia, China, Iran primarily, is kind of the new force. I can see why guys are like, nah, it's paper tiger stuff, don't buy into that. I would say
the
demographics, like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, ZOG, NATO, the West, the Jews, yeah. Like this is clearly the top world power. It is the great power of the day. However, I think China and Russia, each in their own right, is a great power. They both have nuclear bombs, and they have the means to deliver them, and they have many other capabilities, and they're great empires, and they're civilization states. So those two I would put kind of roughly like in the same league and not all that much farther below ZOG in terms of power. I think the key thing about ZOG today is just that it's overextended, and it doesn't have the ability to make a decision due to the nature of like of the Jewish oligarchy. I don't think even if ZOG could somehow realize that even if the elites could realize that it is in their collective interest to calm things down a bit, and maybe not like fight to the death over, Donbass, I don't think they actually could make that decision and enforce it on their own system. So they're sort of trapped in their own like death spiral. In Iran, Yeah, RAND, I would say, is a regional power. It's certainly not as powerful as Russia or China, but they are kind of like one of the few countries in the world that has some independence and kind of can play different countries, go to different patrons or sponsors and try to work with one group or the other and maintain a sort of a precarious independence. So,
sure. Picking your brain again here, big guy, what would you want to see happen in the United States in terms of the cause and the movement going forward? Obviously, we got the NJP wreckage in the rearview mirror. I mentioned the proliferation of active clubs, which I'm glad to see, but I'm not exactly bullish on that as like a means to move things forward. You know, a smattering of things left and right, but it's still scattershot and not particularly effective aside from the information war. Would you want to see a party go again? Would you want to see the white civil rights organization get going? I won't ask if you would like to see a revolutionary underground start to build up. But you know, you got
what about a weather underground?
Well, you know, they had their own issues. Great Days of Rage by Brian Burroughs, great book about the craziness of the late 60s and the 70s, which of course petered out too. And Greg too is, you know, going back to the comments about the show, it's like, you know, we sort of had a heyday. We, meaning a lot of us old timers, with the rise of the alt-right and feeling like things were moving in one direction. And obviously it got, deliberately derailed by a system that was a little bit spooked by everything that was going on, but the spirit is still there and possibly the energy too. Maybe I don't have my finger on the pulse as much, but back to the original question, you know, what would you like to see ideally in the Conte world in terms of a structure?
We certainly need, we as whites need to build a political block, and that can only be done. That has to be done by Hitlerian methods, and you know, legal methods, of course. But yeah. We have to build a block, a political block for whites, a mass movement of whites. And I think the key thing that I've been thinking about, especially since October. You know, since the Palestine war started, is you have this great opportunity right now to criticize Jewish power. And because
greatest in our lifetimes, probably. Yep.
Any political movement has to proceed from the assumption that the only way to get any single thing that we want as whites must happen, can only happen under conditions where the existing elite is totally removed from power. Yep. And therefore, you know, any other kind of politics, like, well, maybe we could get an immigration change. No, you can't get anything. You will get nothing. Goyim always lose under Jewish control. So we have to take back control of our country. And therefore it follows that you need to build a white mass movement. But I do think, in terms of like the propaganda, I think something that we haven't really realized up until now, we've been a bit naive, is that we need to, every single issue, every political issue, whether it be immigration or foreign policy wars or opioids or economic depression or BlackRock buying up every house in the country, every single thing comes down to Jews. And we have to, that is the one point we have to hammer to people in our activism, in our propaganda and everything we do. We have to get every normie, and not just whites, we have to get everybody to understand it's Jews, they're in charge, they're responsible. So I don't think, I know in the past we've done things like, we've kind of done the, you know, black crime or something. Like, black crime is awful, and it's totally the result of Jewish power and Jews being in control. Like, who makes these prosecutorial decisions that allow black criminals to kill whites, like, and to get away with it? Jews. So like, that needs to be the core of everything we say, because it's in politics, like, it's too, we can't make things complicated. We have to make it super, 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 super simple. And the one core truth of our age is that Jews run everything. And if you want change, you have to throw them out of power.
Oh, but that's Jew focus, Greg. That's not nuance. That's
I was told it's not Jews, it's rich versus poor. Everybody knows that, stupid.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll give some subtlety. We'll say Jewish elites, and Jews and their white puppets.
Sure. Which, No, it has the virtue of being true, and it becomes more and more obvious with every passing day. And they are great at self-owning themselves, from Rabbi Shmuley to Ben Shapiro.
And we know that this is the approach that they're afraid of. They're afraid, like, they write whole books. But they write whole books about, like, what if the Nazis teamed up with the Arabs? That would be super bad. And it's like, you know, not to say that, like, right now we need to, like, go to Mecca and, you know, say, hey, Arabs, like, we're teaming up for the ultimate.
Not with that attitude.
Like, no, we're not doing that. But when you see Zog's, like nightmare fantasies, they're kind of like masochistic. They like to, like, envision their own doom. But when you see the kinds of things that they put forth as, like, this would be really bad if the blacks and the whites and the Hajis all teamed up and were anti-Semitic, you kind of see what they're afraid of. I went to a Palestine rally back in November or something in DC, and just to kind of see, right? And it struck me that, you know, it was very clear that the whole thing was being run by Jews, and they were trying to defend away from the Jewish issues. They were saying a lot of this stuff about, like, it's not Judaism, it's Zionism. And you see these Arabs just kind of standing there, like kind of just staring and, like, okay, whatever. But it struck me as, like, why is it that 2% that these Jews can somehow have no freaking problem going out in the street and going up to an Arab and saying, like, hey, your cause is my cause. And also we have a tranny faggot flag here. Like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yep. Like, we Nazis actually have something to sell all of these people. We have a better deal for them. You know, all other racial groups, we have a better deal to offer them. And we also have, you know, honesty, which Jews don't have. Other races know this. Or they can be made to understand it.
The one struggle stuff, you know, you take it with a grain of salt, and half of those people would probably kill you, honky, if they had a chance. But when you encounter a sincere counter-Semite or anti-Zionist, whether he's black, Chinese, whatever, on the internet or in real life, that is a common cause. that is,
you know, right. I mean, people need to understand the difference. Like, we're not saying go up to that guy and invite him over to your house and, like, get him engaged to your sister. You know, no one's saying that. But, like, we whites need to, in order for there to be any political change, obviously we whites need to organize ourselves and then be able to offer these other groups deals that they're going to be like, because the choice ultimately for everybody is, do you want white power or Jewish power?
Amen, brother. From gangster rappers to the poorest mother in a hovel in Palestine, the ranks of the victims and the sincere opposition span the world. It's the truth. And as indisputably, the most compassionate and most competent race here, we have a place in partnering with them, or at least extending a hand of friendship. Doesn't have to be any genocides or cruelties necessarily. Separate spaces for our own races, and get rid of the occupiers and the whip hand that's over all of us together. I absolutely agree with you. That's all I got in my stack, and I'm going to have a lot more for next week, but I'm not going to go into it this week. So last call, Sam, Rollo, Greg, I think we can probably land this puppy, but that's just my opinion.
Well, I wanted to talk about the thing that Murdoch posted.
Yeah, please do, Rollo, because that was the first I heard about it. What did he post? And yeah, why should the audience care?
So yeah, there were people talking about when's the next Murdoch? Murdoch, why don't they do anymore? It's sad. And then Murdoch chimed in and he said, "We've won." And
I'm instantly dubious.
What his comment was, he said, just look around everywhere. Everyone is adopting our talking points for the first time in probably ever. Mm-hmm. Like we've never lived, like there's never been a world where there's been this many people that are this aware. And when I saw that, I was like, you know what? That is actually a pretty interesting point. I've never seen it put that way. And like you brought up, you know, the ratio central mm-hmm. with, I don't know, Joey Bag of Donuts senator, like Israel's the greatest thing ever. We need to protect Israel and black trannies at all costs. And then just, and it, yeah. And it's, and it's
random congressman just saying, I stand with Israel. Like just say that you are being held hostage or that you are totally owned by them. It's crystal clear. And everybody sees it now too. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. And it's not, it's not just like, you know, Pepe's and Gripers. It's like regular people are like, yeah, dude, it's Jews. Like, yep. You know, don't you dare lie to me.
Yeah. And I'm sorry.
It's interesting. They bring up Rollo. He's totally wrong. Like, oh, okay. So people are acknowledging the problem, but
Jews are
still the ones in charge.
The point,
like the elite hasn't changed, and like we're run by like elite pedophile cliques, and kids are being turned into trannies. Like you're telling me that this is it? That this was the ultimate objective?
No, it's ridiculous. Don't get too autistic over it, because he was we didn't actually win. It's more apparent now that we actually have some power and a chance. Like, I don't agree that we win, but it was an interesting
I mean, is that what he meant? Like that we just like, this
it doesn't
is it.
Matter. Won, well, calm down, calm down, calm down, calm down. If you disagree, kill yourself, because like, there's no hope. We can't win and just go home. It's just, it's a nice white pill that just like, okay, you know what? Like, it's not completely hopeless. Like,
yeah, he's saying our points are gotten out there.
And they're worldwide, and
points have gotten out there. Like, fine, fair enough, but
I know. Don't think too hard on it. Like, you can't have that attitude. Like, you need to be more lenient with a lot of things, or else there's no point. Like, this goes back to the argument, like oh well, this person said this, yeah, but they didn't say 1488 afterwards. So like, well, say like, shut up. Like, who cares? It's like the fact that regular
like progress,
people, you can have a conversation with regular people and you can bring up race and Jews. And like, if you did that 10 years ago, like you would be exiled from almost all your social circles, probably fired from your job. Like everyone would get on the horn, because this is one thing I do believe: it is illegal to be pro-white. Now, it doesn't mean they can handcuff you, read you your rights, and sentence you. I sentence you 10 years for being pro-white. But they can get you fired from your job. They can get you separated from your family. They can get you removed from your bank. There's more than one type of prison. But now we do live in a world where just regular people are tired of shit that Jews are pulling. That like regular people are out there, they're just calling out Zionism. And I don't care that they're just like saying like, oh, well, you know, those imperialist bad white country. Jews.
Yeah.
Well, that, yeah. Like, yeah. Like at this point, like beggars can't be choosers. And I do agree that a lot of those people, they're anti-Zionist because they think Israelis are white that are just stomping on those poor brown people. But that's not how Jews see it. It's disrupting Jewish life, and every Palestinian Jews kill, they lose more and more support, and they're not stopping. So there is actual hope. And there's a lot of times where I've just been like, dude, like, what are we doing? Like, like, why bother anything?
Just try to survive the coming collapse. The downside, of course, Rollo, is that, you know, it's Biden or Trump in November. Not to harp on the election stuff, but you're getting
what about Kennedy?
A liberal Zionist or a conservative or a, you know, a populist Zionist.
I'm a globalist and a nationalist.
Kennedy.
Yeah, well, Cornel West too. Your buddy Cornell might still be. He's running. I think there's Cornel West, there's Kennedy, and maybe even Jill Stein again this year. Maybe she and Cornel West are on the same Green Party ticket. But I honestly, if Kennedy didn't have that old woman voice affliction, I think I'm going to channel the spirit of my family.
He sounds like one of the Golden Girls.
Blanche, that's the first name that came to my mind. Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's a serious handicap for a politician. He sounds like an old woman, and I understand that he's got some medical condition. But
no excuse. Zero.
The best Kennedy will be at best a spoiler in every single poll that I've seen. Trump does either as well or better when you include the third or fourth party candidates in the polling. Now, whether that's legit or not, but you know, Trump, I cynically support Trump, of course, in this cycle, because I do think the shakeup is better than more of the same, even if he is the world's biggest Zionist and really an Israel firster. Half of our success and enthusiasm and upswing and outreach during the previous cycle, 2015, 2017, if you want to call it, was in part due to the fact that we felt like we were swimming with the current, with that powerful political force happening that we had optimism for. And this time, I think very few people who are genuinely enthusiastic about Trump, and it's mostly pure cynicism, aside from, of course, the MAGA faithful who view him as a deity. But you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I'd rather gamble. You're not exactly sure what you're going to get with him in this second tranche, assuming that it even happens.
Oh, I got a hot take.
Damn sure know what you're going to get with Biden. Go ahead.
Here's a hot take. Biden has been doing the whole like, oh, you Israel, you can't be doing that. We're going to cut support. Yeah, but then in comes, you know, Zion Dawn to be like, oh, I will not abandon our ally Israel. I will send all of our weapons to them and all of our nukes so they can throw them back at us.
He hasn't done that. He had one interview where he was like, it looks terrible. You know, they really shouldn't be doing this, you know, but I think, you know, and that was why I said people should go to Trump rallies and boo if he does any sort of shilling whatsoever, because if nothing else, he does know how public opinion works. And do I think that that's actually going to impact his appointments and his policy? No, I don't. But I think he's pretty savvy when it comes to knowing what works and what doesn't work from what we've seen in the past. And even he, I think, is going to have to dial it back, at least in terms of rhetoric, even if it's going to be, you know,
not if he believes that he's helping them win or like bring in their satanic messiah. Sure. Hail Mary.
Yeah, heifers. Or yeah, I'm going to be hostile to the invasion of Gaza only because it's bad for Israel. I'm going to help you de-escalate this thing and be the peacemaker. Yeah, it's whenever I get like the slightest enthusiasm for him, because there is a lot of good rhetoric and campaign plans, at least in terms of personnel and deportations and immigration enforcement, that would be a material benefit to so many of us. And then he goes and says something that just makes you kind of puke in your mouth. Sam, last thoughts, anything? We'll talk to you next week. Don't worry, I'm not going to cancel the show. Just had to vent.
Yeah, well, a little bit. We'd have to carry on without you, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah. So
remember when Jazz Hands at one point was like, we're going to do a dad show. I was like, all right. Okay. Little competition. Finally, that never materialized.
Well, you may remember also the halfway house. Remember that?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Who could forget?
Hang that over my head. I did appreciate the sandstorm at the end. Was that your idea, Rollo? A little.
I can't remember. I was the water, one that said it. Yeah, I can't remember if it was water or I that suggested it, but we definitely made the reference.
You played it. So well, we'll get back under Mike next week. Sammy, baby, thank you.
Yeah.
Happy belated Easter. And
happy Easter.
Very, very, very exciting to talk to your son and his lovely new bride. Rollo, my friend, thank you for slogging it out. I know you are still not feeling 100%, but you're always down to play injured all the same.
I'm also down to play some MTG.
Yeah, Rollo is watching Marjorie Taylor Greene. What the hell is
MTG? Heck yeah.
Magic the Gathering. Yeah.
Rollo's got MTG on his wall. I should have known. And Greg Conte, damn pleasure to finally have you on Full House. Thank you for everything that you've contributed, sacrificed, and continue to for our people and our cause. I mean that damn sincerely.
Oh, thank you very much, Coach. And it's been a pleasure to be on with all three of you guys.
You bet. Damn glad to be your friend. And we'll link Prussian Socialism, the articles. I'll probably go to the original Occidental Observer and keep us posted on your book. And when the book is out, if you want to spurg out a little bit on that in German language and the book itself, would be happy to have you back. All right, everybody. Full House episode 183. I don't know if we'll call it the Seville Inquisition or Continuity. just kidding. But we'll think about it. Was recorded on it was a perfect Sunday, April 7th. It's now April 8th, 2024. Don't forget about your taxes. It is actually April 15th this year. I am not a sovereign citizen argument advocate. I think you're more trouble. Don't worry, Sammy, baby. You got the closing music. I got that track. I haven't lost it. I'm still confident here at the helm. And hey, since we didn't recommend, we raised awareness of the Bitcoin ETFs out there for people who maybe weren't willing to mess around with wallets or anything like that. We hit all time. We broke through the previous all time high. We hit 73. Last I checked, it was 70 or 69, and the halving is about 12 days away. Basically, if you listened to us that episode and bought a little bit of Bitcoin, you'd be doing well. I think long term, that is still a valuable hedge and potentially life changing investment for people out there. But that is not professional financial advice. I think that's just stuff that I've watched. There's a lot of cultists out there in crypto space for sure. There's a lot of FUD. There's a lot of garbage. There's a lot of clear shills. But I think when you look at the commentary on it in total, both from the BlackRock Larry Fink types to Joe Crypto on Twitter, when you take that in totality, I think the thing's got legs long term, despite the roller coaster of the ride. And you'd probably do well to get off of zero, to own some. Even the financial pros are saying allocate 1%, 2% in your portfolio, and you don't have to do it with your cold hard cash. Now you can do it with whatever you got socked away for retirement. If you don't, good. Maybe I'll be wrong. If you do, maybe you'll get wealthy and you can be grateful at the end. So to close us out this week, Sammy Baby has got the DJ booth, and let the audience know, please, my friend, what they're going to hear.
Yeah. The song is Suppression of Faith by the band Squadron. The song goes back to 1997. But in the last couple of years, I don't know, within the last year, it's come back out, been repressed, remastered to vinyl. And it just got me listening to it again and remembering what a great song it was. Squadron goes back to 1985 is when they started. They really were like a skinhead oi band. But as they progressed into the 90s, they became more metal, I will call it, but you know, very nuanced, very artistic, really, I think. Very
avant-garde.
No, not avant-garde. Just a really solid, good songwriting, great lyrics, and so it's a great tune. I think it's this one really kind of gets me going.
Where are they from?
England.
Nice. Squadron, yeah. Suppression of Faith. Cool name for a band. Good track name. Track name too. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Rollo. Thanks, Sam. Thank you, audience, yeah, for riding with us. And we love you, fam. And we will talk to you next week. Greg, we say see ya at the end of every show. It's yours. See if he gets it. You can say see ya. Well done. Hurrah.
Suppression of faith. The suppression of faith.